Welcome to the Healthy Mouth World Summit live Q&A expert session here. Today we have the awesome honor of having Sarah Pope with us, the Healthy Home Economist, and she gets to share her story with us and answer your questions. Before we get into the question and answer session, I want to make sure that we cover some housekeeping. We have a very full call today. We'll do our best to get all your questions answered. Like I mentioned, if you can type in your questions, that'll make it really go very quickly. If you do want to ask us specific questions over the audio, by all means, raise your hand and we'll call you in. Last, thank you all for your interest in educating yourself how to navigate to greater oral health. And we're finding that the Healthy Mouth World Summit is being such a great avenue to share information like this and getting lots and lots of thank you emails. And of course, thank you goes out to Sarah Pope here for fielding your calls here today. So let's just jump right in. I have a bunch of questions here already lining up. So, Sarah, this question is from Robin, and I think you covered this, but let's throw out a couple questions here to you right off the bat. What brand of fermented cod liver oil do you recommend that includes the vitamin A and D?
Well, you know, if you're going to use cod liver oil to try to improve your oral health or to reverse a cavity, you really need to get the right kind. And in the presentation, I covered why this is so. And the reason is that most of the cod liver oils, every single one that I've seen in the health food store, they're processed. The living daylights is processed out of them, okay? And when you process the living daylights out of a food, you destroy all the good stuff about it. And you make it basically worthless at that point. And that's really what you're looking at the cod liver oils in the health food store. They've been heated to very, very high temperatures, and they've been industrially processed. And, you know, if you go to my blog, I have a blog post that kind of details the history of cod liver oil. But basically, 150 years ago, they discovered, because cod liver oil is a traditional food, it's been used for centuries. But 150 years ago or so, they discovered, hey, if we heat this really hot, guess what? We can get the oil out of these livers in like one day instead of 6 months, which is what it had traditionally taken. You know, and the fermented cod liver oil is processed the traditional way the Romans and the Vikings and all the people prior to the Industrial Revolution produced their cod liver oil. They basically would just throw the livers in a bucket. And, you know, the South Sea Islanders would take the liver of a shark and put it in the stomach and hang it on a tree and just kind of leave it there for a while. And it would ferment and the oil would naturally render and come out of the liver. And then at that point, when the oil was rendered, is when they would use it. But this was a very time consuming process. And the Industrial Revolution figured that, hey, if we heat this in a factory, guess what? We can get this oil in a day, and that's a lot quicker, and that's great for production. We can increase our profits and all of that stuff. But guess what? It destroys the oil.
Yeah.
Destroys the A and the D. So what you need to do is get the fermented cod liver oil. There's only one company currently in the world that produces this. This is Green Pasture Products out of Nebraska. If you Google greenpasture.org, I have visited this facility myself. I have toured the facility. I know the owner personally, and this stuff's awesome. It's the only one I will take. Now, there's another cod liver oil supposedly coming out in the next few months that's also raw. It's not fermented, but it's raw, but it's not yet available on the market. So I'm hopeful in the next few months there is going to be another brand available that is also good, that is rendered traditionally. It's not fermented, but it will be rendered traditionally. So keep tabs on my blog when that comes out. I will write about it. And I tried it at the Wise Traditions Conference, and it seems to be a very good product. But I will review it and talk about it on my blog when it becomes available. But for now, greenpasture.org is where you need to go.
Perfect, perfect.
That's a long answer to that. Sorry about that, Will.
Well, you know, I mean, to get the FCLO question right out of the way and to get Green Pasture's name out there, we'll tackle some of these other questions at the same time, yeah. Too.
Well, you know, people need to understand the reason why, you know, and that's why I want to take a minute to talk about the history of cod liver oil, and that's pretty important.
It truly is. I mean, the devil's in the details. Just because the product is still the product, in a sense, it's the details. It kind of reminds me of historically the difference between, let's say, the historical Listerine, which was actually a really good product. It was made out of essential oils like eugenol and thymol, which are the essential oils from thyme and clove oil. But then, you know, again, like you said, mass production and profit lines get in the way, and they realized, hey, wait a second, if we just used alcohol and just put a little flavoring in there, it would achieve the same thing. But the problem is that the alcohol actually dries the mucosal tissue and therefore increases the risk of gum disease versus the essential oils like our blend that increase saliva production. So again, the devil's in the details.
Yep, that's right.
Okay, this same person is asking about, it makes sense about robbing nutrients and not giving the body the need, what it needs from fast food or processed foods, what she does not eat. What she's wondering is the health benefits that you see from some raw foods, for example, like a chocolate mousse that is made from avocado and carob with no sugar involved. You know, what do you think about the nutrients in foods such as this?
Well, I'm trying to make sure I understand the question. I want to answer her question correctly. Is she talking about maybe sweet foods, treat foods that are made with whole ingredients? Is that what she means? What do I think about those?
I think so, yeah.
Is that what you're getting at? Hopefully that's what she's getting at. Well, that's what I'll answer. Yes, those are fine. And you know what? We have taste buds that sense sweet. And there is nothing wrong with eating a sweet treat. There's certainly nothing wrong with even a hamburger. And I've got and when I make French fries in my home, the problem with fast food is not the burger and the fries. The problem is how they produce the burger and the fries. It's the processing and the sourcing of the ingredients that's the problem. The idea of hamburger and French fries is not necessarily bad. I mean, we have burgers and fries in my home, but guess what? We use grass-fed beef. We use sourdough buns. We use organic potatoes, and they're fried at the lowest temperature possible in beef tallow, which is a very healthy oil that does not go rancid when you fry things in it. Unlike, let's compare the meal I just described to you, you know, the burger and fries in my home that I serve to my family. Let's compare that to fast food. You've got the patty, which is, you know, mystery meats coming from confined animals that have been fed genetically modified corn and soy on a feedlot for 6 months or so before they're slaughtered inhumanely. And then you've got, you know, they've been treated with all manner of drugs. Some of these drugs are not withdrawn up until the day of slaughter. And there is residue of these drugs in the meat. And so then you've got your white bread that's full of sugar and preservatives and other chemicals. You've got your condiments that are loaded with high fructose corn syrup, and you've got your potatoes that are conventional potatoes grown in pesticide-laden dirt that are fried in an oil that they love to tell you it's trans fat-free, but what does that mean? It's still vegetable oils. It's oils that may not be trans fat, but they're processed in another way. Perhaps they're what's called interesterified, which is another way to process vegetable oils. It's not trans fats, but it's just as bad. And then because they're using vegetable oils, the fries don't have this wonderful meaty flavor that we all like that you naturally get from tallow if you make them at home. So like, what do they have to do? They have to add large amounts of MSG to these vegetable oils to give the fries that meaty, delicious flavor that we all love.
Right.
That you can naturally get from a healthy oil. So, you know, don't get caught up in the burger and fries are bad. Get caught up in the sourcing of the food, which is low quality food that doesn't have much in the way of nutrient value, and also how they cook it, how they prepare it. Those are the problems with fast food.
Yeah, right there. Again, the devil's in the details. It's fun to be able to eat the most delicious foods out there that we've always since childhood have enjoyed. And, you know, it's like we'll occasionally make a delicious pudding here or a chocolate milk at home. But again, it's with raw milk and it's mostly cream and a touch of raw honey off of the property here and a little bit of raw cocoa. So, and a couple of egg yolks. So it makes a big difference where you're getting your foods.
That's right. That's right.
Okay, how about, this question's from Dina here. What are your thoughts on eating eggshells and swishing with comfrey root for oral health? As well as a question, is xylitol as a sweetener? I know that you got some opinions there that you can share.
Yes, well, I'm not on the comfrey, swishing the comfrey root in the eggshells. It's not something I've done personally. Perhaps, Will, you can answer that. Maybe you've done some research on that. Sure. That's not something I do. But with regard to xylitol, you do need to be careful about xylitol. Xylitol is a sugar alcohol. It does have issues in the body and causes problems in the body. It's not a natural sweetener. And if you want to, just to give you some idea about xylitol, the two pieces of xylitol gum has enough xylitol in it to kill a rat. So it's toxic to members of the animal kingdom. It's marketed as a natural sweetener, and in a lot of cases it comes from genetically modified corn. But even if it comes from beets, even if it's an organic xylitol, it's not something that you want to be consuming. It does cause digestive distress. There are problems with it. I actually have quite a detailed blog on xylitol. If you go to thehealthyhomeeconomist.com and in the search box up there in the header, type in xylitol. A fairly detailed post that is linked to some scientific references that you can check out will list for you the problems with xylitol. Now, I'm not saying that you should never have a piece of xylitol gum. A piece of xylitol gum once in a while is not going to be a problem. And if you want to use it therapeutically to help with it, it's been shown in some studies to help resolve a childhood ear infection without antibiotics, I would say that using a therapeutic dose of xylitol in a product such as Irisoris or something like that to resolve your child's ear infection without antibiotics, I would say that's probably okay. I just don't think you should be buying it, using it as a regular sweetener in your home. You shouldn't be chewing xylitol gum every single day. And actually, I've got a video coming out soon, and I actually was wondering today if I should maybe put it up tomorrow. Maybe I should. Maybe I should post it tomorrow on my blog that talks about healthy alternatives to xylitol gum. And because a lot of people, you know, you don't want to chew the sugar gum. Right. We know that. We don't want to chew the aspartame gum. But a lot of people have turned to the xylitol gum, and that's really not good either. And if you want to choose something, there are healthy alternatives, and I've done a video on it, and maybe I should just go ahead and post it tomorrow.
Well, I look forward to seeing that one. Yeah. Okay. This one's from Tiffany. She's on the phone here with us. She says, my daughter is 7, has lost her front baby teeth, and now has her adult front teeth. One of these is coming in crooked. In your opinion, can she change this through diet, organ meats, cod liver oil? What would be a good substitute for dairy since they are sensitive or allergic to it?
Well, a couple things here. The palate of a child, which determines whether the teeth come in nice and straight, that's really determined in the womb. And also very early childhood, the first few years of life, maybe up till 5 years old, but not too much beyond that. So, no, if your daughter's teeth are coming in crooked, there's not a whole lot you can do about it at this point. Now, don't be discouraged, though. I mean, cod liver oil, butter oil is still very good for their oral health. And we'll keep the teeth that come in to be cavity-free, keep your gums nice and healthy. You still want to incorporate all those healthy aspects into your diet. What Dr. Weston Price recommended in situations where there is not enough, there's crowding, there's not enough room for the teeth, as in your daughter's situation, consult with a holistic orthodontist who will widen the palate. Don't go to an orthodontist who wants to pull teeth in order to ensure enough room there and reduce the crowding. You want to widen the palate there. That is a fine thing to do. There's nothing wrong with seeking orthodontic intervention if that's what you need. And probably you do at this point. There's really not a whole lot that can be done at 7 years old. Now, with regard to the dairy situation, if you're sensitive to dairy, I don't know if she's tried raw or not.
Yeah.
That was not indicated in the question there. If you have not, Tiffany, if you've not tried raw milk, you really need to try it, because a lot of people who are sensitive to the processed milks at the store, including the organic processed milks, they find that, you know what, raw doesn't bother me at all. And that happened to my husband. He is fine with raw dairy. But if you are one of the, you know, few people that are sensitive even to raw grass-fed dairy, what you're going to have to do is you're really going to have to incorporate a lot of bone broths into your diet. That's really the only other alternative to dairy to get enough calcium. The traditional cultures that Weston Price studied who did not do dairy did lots and lots of bone broth. And I'm talking about every day. every other day at the, every other day would be the minimum. You need to be making lots of bone broth, lots of soups, sauces, and, even just drinking cups of bone broth with your meals.
Right. That's a perfect segue into a question from Sarah here, who is familiar with your blog. And she's curious, and I, you and I together could talk on this one subject for well over an hour, Sarah, I'm sure. She's curious if there are any risks to consuming bone broth daily, assuming the bones are good, are from an organic and a natural source. For example, are there elements in the concentrate of the from the bones or the ligaments that could be harmful if consumed at every meal?
No.
Yeah, I agree.
There's your short answer. No, bone broth, no, it's a nutrient-dense food. You really just drink it with every meal is fine. And in fact, at Sarah, the GAPS diet to heal and seal the gut wall. This is for people who are suffering from, any myriad of autoimmune disorders. A lot of them choose to go on the GAPS diet to resolve their health challenges. That particular diet calls for bone broth with every single meal.
Yeah. I agree that, the benefits that I've experienced on a nutritional and an immunological level of incorporating way more stocks. I mean, at this point we have, we do it in a crock pot and I don't know, we could probably split hairs onto whether or not that's really the optimal way to do it, but it functions for our family. And we literally have it going every day of the week, it seems like at this point, as soon as, we eat off of it, kind of like the old style Italian family minestrone on the back of the stove, that they just add whatever leftovers into that. We pull off of this stock pot, into whatever we're having. It really is truly a foundational food for health, in my opinion.
Yes, you really just have it with every meal. It's wonderful to have. We have pretty much a half a gallon in my refrigerator at all times. And my kids, a lot of times, will just have a cup of broth with their dinner if I haven't had an opportunity to make a soup or whatever. Particularly this time of year, the flus are going around, the colds are going around, the tummy bugs are rampant. Incorporating lots of bone broth into your diet is really going to be very protective for you.
Yeah. Yeah. Folks, sign up. Our blog is really young. We're total novices and learning from pros like Sarah at this. But we have a lot to say about food from our perspective of understanding food, how it relates to oral health, as well as our background being in the Chinese longevity arts. There's this whole traditional Chinese medical influence in our thinking, which is how we have learned to function in the kitchen, that I think you'd really enjoy hearing about. And it dovetails so well with nutrient-dense foods. So another question here from Jennifer. With regards to soaking grains, do you think that using sourdough breaks down the phytic acid?
Yes, the phytic acid is not completely broken down by any of the traditional methods of preparing grains. There's three methods. There's sour leavening, which is sourdough. There's sprouting the grain, and there's also soaking the fresh flour. And you can also combine methods if you'd like. In other words, you can sourdough sprouted flour if you want, or soak sprouted flour. However, there's a lot of different ways you can implement that. But yes, it breaks the phytic acid down, and it breaks it down enough where you can absorb the minerals that are in the grain. But again, just because this is a mistake I see with people frequently, is that once they incorporate traditional methods of grain preparation in their home, they think, oh, grains, I can eat as much as I want, and they maybe eat too much. And you have to be careful there. Grains are a wonderful traditional food, but our modern culture just eats way too many grains.
Yeah.
And so going to a traditional method of preparing grains is great. And yes, we do eat grains in my home, but we eat way, way, way less than, typical Americans out there. So you need to watch out for it. I mean, if you think about the Swiss culture just for a minute here, they would have maybe one or two pieces of rye bread a day. And it was with a very thick slab of raw butter on top, and that was, their lunch or whatever. And, then they would have some sort of a stew for dinner, that type of thing. But you need to, they weren't eating it, grains all day long, and it wasn't the basis of their diet,
right?
Like it is for Americans.
Sure, the food pyramid. Yeah, I think you really just hit it there. I mean, when we have some good sourdough in our house or something like that, it's more or less an excuse or another novel way to enjoy more butter, really.
That's right. It's a vehicle to get that butter into your stomach, right?
Yeah, truly. That's actually my question. It's like, I wonder if I can overdo it on butter. I don't, you know, I'm kind of guinea pigging myself on this right now because we're just having a lot of fun with quality fresh butter.
Butter is just such a wonderful food.
It is. Okay. Let's see. This question is from Randa. What should we do or not do as far as typical dental checkups and cleanings? Anything to avoid specifically? What's your take on routine? We have to really pigeonhole this here and say routine conventional dentistry versus more of a biological or preventive approach.
Well, I'll tell you what we do in our house. Well, first of all, I mean, when I was a kid, I got a cleaning once a year. They didn't want to x-ray me every year. They did want to do fluoride on me, which unfortunately I did get fluoride treatments as a child. I was fortunate that I didn't get any white spots on my teeth from that. But yeah, I did get fluoride. My dad is an MD. He would only permit us to have bite wings every 5 years and a full set of x-rays, dental x-rays every 10 years.
Wow, good for dad.
That was my dad. That was my dad's rule of thumb. That is something I have continued in my home. My children have only had, none of my children have had a full set of x-rays, dental x-rays. They've had bite wings. I think my oldest one, my 14-year-old, has had one set of bite wings in his life. And I think my younger ones, I don't think they've had any bite wings at all. They may not have, they've gone, you know, just to the the holistic orthodontist to kind of, who's checked their bite to make sure everything's coming in nice and straight, which fortunately it is at this point. And they have had one of those x-rays where it's kind of an open x-ray machine where you stand there and the x-ray machine spins around your head.
Right, a Panasonic. Panoramic, excuse me.
Yeah, panoramic. And those are pretty low radiation from what I understand.
Yeah.
My younger children have each had one of those, but they haven't had any conventional dental x-rays. Cleanings, my kids go once a year. They don't have fluoride treatments. They don't have x-rays. I just take them in and they get a cleaning and that's it. And, you know, I've gone back and forth with dentists. Is it enough to just get a regular dentist who's pretty conventional in approach and just allows you to skip the x-rays and the fluoride treatment? That's the kind of dentist I went to for a long time. But you know what? I just got sick and tired of the dirty looks. I got sick and tired of them looking at me like I was some crazy mom who wouldn't let her kids get fluoride and wouldn't let her kids get x-rays. I just kind of got sick and tired of it. And now I just go to Dr. Bim, who interestingly is going to be one of the speakers here.
Yeah, that's fun.
In the Healthy Mouth Summit here in the next few days. He lives in my area. And, you know, he's a long drive away from me. It's an hour each way. But you know what? I don't get dirty looks when I go to him. He welcomes my children with open arms and doesn't give me a hassle about not having x-rays or fluoride. And you know what? It's just worth the drive. And I'm just going to him from now on. So that's kind of what I do.
Right, right. And Randy, if I can throw in a couple of pennies here of ideas here. As far as dental checkups and cleanings, obviously it really, really depends on where a person is individually is. If you got a bunch of problems going on, if your health really isn't where it could be, if you're just getting started with taking control of your oral health as well as a whole being wellness, then you'll need more interventions from other experts like dentists or doctors or whoever. However, that said, if a person is working on improving their immunological health, then you got to kind of be careful getting regular, in my opinion, cleanings. You know, there's plenty of research out there that shows that the levels of bad bugs in the blood goes quite high after a dental cleaning. In fact, if a person who is at risk of heart disease, before any dental work, it's suggested that they go on antibiotics for it, which is crazy, in my opinion. But, you know, still, for a person who is severely at risk of heart disease, because the bad bugs do get pushed into the bloodstream during a dental cleaning. So, you know, in my opinion, it shouldn't just be an unthought consideration. You really need to weigh whether or not exposing yourself to the, how shall we say this nicely, to the interference, whether or not that's going to be in your best interest or not. So it's something we each have to weigh.
Okay. That's interesting. I didn't know that well about the antibiotics. That is crazy. That's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. They realized it kind of empirically, kind of like, wow, why are people who are at risk at heart attacks dropping dead the day after their dental appointment?
Wow.
You know, so yeah. This question from Monica here. Does Sarah have any information on how the tooth structure was restored in her first son's cavity? Was there more silica or chondroitin in his diet?
When my oldest son, I assume she's talking about when the hole in behind my oldest son's incisor filled in.
Yes.
I added raw butter to his diet and butter oil to his diet. That was really the only change. I mean, he eats very, very well anyway. We just tweaked. It was just a couple of tweaks, and that's what it was. I would imagine it was the vitamin K2 that was in the raw butter and the butter oil in particular. And what vitamin K2 does is it facilitates the calcium into the bones. Vitamin K2 puts the calcium where it's supposed to be and keeps the calcium out of where it's not supposed to be. So K2 not only puts the calcium into your bones, it also keeps the calcium out of your arteries. It keeps it out of your joints and out of your muscles. So helps keep you pain-free, your muscles pain-free, and also keeps the arterial plaques from building up in your arteries. So vitamin K2 is important for your oral health, but it's also very important for cardiovascular health. So I think that's what it was. I think his tooth just recalcified. Right. And the additional K2 that we added to his diet through the raw butter and the raw butter oil just facilitated the calcium that he was already getting in his diet through bone broth, raw dairy, and that kind of thing, just helped get that calcium in there a little bit better.
And I think a point that you brought up right here, Sarah, is really crucial to really hammer home. You know, we have a culture at large that thinks that they are calcium deficient. And in truth, they might be, but they're also just calcium misplacing. Their bodies don't have the nutrients, like you're mentioning here, K2, to actually properly appropriate calcium in the body. And so you got a bunch of free calcium floating around, which is damaging to the body. And the
That's
body goes,
right.
Oh, we're flooded. We got to pack it under the joints or stuff like that.
And it crashes
the system.
It just drives me nuts when I see these people taking all these calcium supplements and their diet is poor. And you know they're not getting enough K2 to handle that calcium. And I'm like, you're just killing yourself with that calcium supplement. Yeah. You know, it's a shame. And that is the danger. You know, that just illustrates the danger of taking supplements in isolation. Nutrients are meant to work synergistically in a holistic manner with the body, and taking supplements in isolation is a dangerous business unless you are under the care of a very, very knowledgeable physician who understands the entire physiology of the body and is looking at everything as he or she is treating you.
Yeah. And Monica, your last little bit of the question here about was there more chondroitin in his diet? Chondroitin is one of the glycosaminoglycans, which is one of the components in bone broth. So yes, he was getting lots of bone broth too. So,
and he was already getting the bone broth, but obviously the calcium wasn't getting where it needed to be. So the extra K2 just kind of nudged the calcium absorption to the level that was necessary to fill in that hole. That's my guess. Obviously, this is just a mom who understands, you know, traditional diets, watching her son's tooth heal.
Right.
Is there a scientific study to back up what happened to his tooth? No, but I believe in the power of observation. And I think that mothers and parents need to fine tune their powers of observation and be very, very vigilant in watching their children. And you know, my children, I know my children so well that when they get up in the morning and I look in their eyes, I know exactly what they need for breakfast. You know, it's a very fine-tuned process. And I think parents need to really open their eyes and realize that they really they live with those kids 24/7. You know your kids better than you think you do, and you need to trust your gut instincts.
Well said. Well said. This, I think that this next question really dovetails with what you're just talking about here, and maybe just continue this conversation. Carla asks, how do vitamins A and D heal teeth? And she thought it was mostly minerals that helped. So I think this is perfect because it is minerals, but it's also fat-soluble vitamins. Can you go into that a little bit?
Sure. Well, of course, the vitamin, it's all synergistic. It's never a simple answer, but just to keep it very basic, vitamin A and D, the fat-soluble activators, vitamin A and D, and let's include K2 here because K2 is very important. It's a triad of synergy there of the fat-soluble activators. What they do is they supercharge the mineral absorption. That's the bottom line. And in other words, you can be starving for minerals. You can be taking in, you know, bone broths and vegetable juicing and all wonderful whole food sources of your minerals, and your body can actually be starving for minerals if you're not getting enough of these fat soluble activators.
Yeah.
Because your body just cannot get them. It can't get them to where they need to go without the these fat soluble activators. So that's the simple answer to that.
Yeah, I think it's very well put. I knew you could field that super well. Question here from Lisa. Would you recommend eating lobster roe, or would it be avoided since lobsters are scavengers?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question. I like roe, and I'll eat roe. I eat lobster as well. You know, different people have different views of seafood. Some don't like to eat clams and mussels because they filter the water, and they're basically a filtering mechanism, and that's how they survive. And you know, that's really up to you. I live on the water. I was raised on the water. I feel seafood is so critical to the diet. Mm-hmm. And the reason is that our soils are so depleted. It's very difficult to get everything you need from land-based foods anymore. Even if you go grass-fed and raw butter and everything, yes, that's all wonderful. But, you know, if you look at the research of Dr. Price, the healthiest populations that he studied, of the 14 traditional populations he studied, the healthiest ones were the seafood-eating cultures.
Mm.
They were the ones that had the lowest rates of cavities. And that's how he judged health, was based on the oral health of these peoples. And he found that the healthier the mouths, the lower even the degenerative disease that these cultures experienced. So, and I think even today, seafood is even more important than it was even during Dr. Price's time, because our soils are even more depleted. So we do eat lobster. We eat roe in our house. We eat, you know, we're smart as we can in sourcing our seafood, but I think that seafood is really a very important part of the diet, and I think the risks from not eating seafood are much greater than eating seafood.
Well put. Well put. There's a couple questions here that I'm just dying to ask you. This one's, sorry if I'm going to butcher your name here, Varia or Varia Kelly, says that she's been a vegan for many years, just wondering if you have any experience with other vegans deciding to take cod liver oil and butter oil. Is it safe to all of a sudden add to a vegan diet?
Well, that's a good question. And you need to start slow. You need to start slow and, you know, don't just dive in headlong and start, you know, eating animal foods like crazy if you've been abstaining from them for a number of years. Start slow and introduce it into your diet and just go slow with it and be very wise and observe how you tolerate it. Now, I have had vegans that did 180s overnight that I know who have, you know, they've gone from eating nothing but plant-based foods to, you know, steak for dinner every night, you know, for weeks and weeks on end. When they decided to make a change, and they were fine
with big broad grins on their faces all along,
you know, and they were fine. And then I've had other vegan friends who had trouble reintroducing the animal fats, and it's usually because they haven't eaten much in the way of fats in a long time. And usually it's a gallbladder issue. Their body, their liver and their gallbladder, just the bile production is just not there really to handle the animal fats. So go slow with it and see how you do.
Yeah, I think that's wise. I'll share a story with you here, Varia, that many years ago I wasn't raised eating any type of mushrooms or anything. And many years ago I got introduced to this whole field of mycology and got all excited. And we were living in Southern Oregon at the time, and this big patch of morel mushrooms popped up, and I said, "That's a morel mushroom. That's like a super sought after. I'm going to pick them and make them." And I had a big plate of them. I'd never had these before. I had a big plate and got violently ill, because my body said, "What the heck is this? I don't know what this is. What? How are we supposed to deal with this?" So, you know, introduce it slowly. Be modest with it. Okay, I got a few others here. I want to save this one because this one I know is you're going to have fun with. But let's come back to that.
Who, me? Have fun with something?
Yeah, really. This is from Janice. Please talk about emulsified fermented cod liver oil versus fermented cod liver oil versus butter oil fermented cod liver oil blends. This is getting down and dirty here.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah. Well, you know, I'm answering these questions right now from my buying club because we're doing a big Green Pastures group order right now. And everybody, you know, several of the new people are like, "Well, what do I get? Do I get the blend? Do I get the emulsified? Do I get the liquid?" So I'm getting all these questions from these folks. Well, you know, what it boils down to is a couple of things. Number one, what's your budget? And do you have a texture issue? That's what you choose, what products you choose is going to be based on those two things. If you are got a really tight budget and you really need to really keep it as per dose as low as possible, then you really need to buy them the liquid cod liver oil, not the emulsified, buy the liquid and buy the butter oil separately. And take them separately. That's the way we do it in our family because we've got five people taking these products every single day. We just crank right on through. We go through a bottle of fermented cod liver oil about every 10 days in our home. So that can get pretty pricey. If budget is really not an issue for you and you're more interested in making sure that it's easy to take, then maybe you want to consider the blends. My parents take the cinnamon fermented cod liver oil, butter oil blend, and they love it. That really works for them. It's very easy because everything's blended up together. The only thing is it's a thicker gel type product. So if you've got texture issues and you don't really like thick stuff or the texture of food is very important to you, then I would recommend just going with the liquid. And the same with the emulsified. The emulsified cod liver oil is thicker than the liquid, and some kids really love it, but some kids who are texture sensitive cannot deal with it. So if you're texture sensitive, stick with the liquid and just take it like I show in the video on my blog, how to take cod liver oil. Yep. Just hold your breath, take it off the spoon and chase it with water, and that's the best way to take it.
Sure. The question here from Judy, can coconut oil be used instead of raw butter? How do those two work?
No, you can't. Coconut oil is fabulous. I don't mean to say anything bad about coconut oil. Coconut oil is a big part of the diet in my home, but coconut oil is a plant food. It's a plant oil. It comes from the coconut. So it doesn't have any vitamin A and D and K2 in it, like you're going to get from your fermented cod liver oil and your butter oil. So coconut oil is one of the healthy fats you should definitely be using in your home. It has a different kind of fat in it. It has medium chain like triglycerides. They're also called MCTs. This is a special type of short chain fatty acid that's used immediately for energy by the body. And people love it, particularly people who work out, because it helps you lose weight, gives you energy. A lot of people find that a tablespoon or two of coconut oil and a cup of herbal tea in the morning is a great pick me up instead of coffee or caffeinated tea. But it is no substitute for your fermented cod liver oil and your butter oil.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. Helpful, but can't be a replacement. Hannah asks over Facebook here, this is the first time I've realized that peanut butter can inhibit vitamin absorption. How much is, quote, safe to eat on a weekly basis? And what about other nut butters?
Yeah, nuts in general are pretty high in phytic acid. Almonds have to be watched out for as well. That's why you really need to soak. If you're eating a lot of nuts in your diet, you really need to soak them carefully in brine water and dehydrate them before you eat them. If you're wondering how to do that, I have a video on my blog about how to do that. But peanut butter, you know, I don't know about what the safe amount is. You know, everybody's so different. My son, I really believe the peanut butter was the cause of his cavities. He loves peanut butter. Like, I've never seen any child love peanut butter as much. He would eat it 3 meals a day. And this was a few years ago. He's older now. He's 10 now. So he's not quite as crazy about peanut butter as he used to be. But, you know, in our home, we only let him have it like 2 or 3 days a week and for one meal. He can have it for breakfast maybe 2 or 3 days a week. And that's what we have implemented in our home. Could he eat it more than that maybe and not have it cause cavity problems? Probably, maybe, but I don't really want to take the risk at this point. I know that just a few days a week works, so that's what we're sticking with.
Sure, sure. let's tackle this fun one here. Person says, isn't there a safety issue with raw milk and the bacteria?
Well, according to government, there is, but, you know, you know, do you want to listen to the government? I don't know. If you're the type of person that really goes by the book, then, you know, then don't drink it. I tell people in my group, if you're afraid of raw milk, don't drink it.
Right.
That's I'm just, if you're afraid of something, just don't do it, because the fear itself is damaging.
Sure.
Even if the food is fine, fear is a very, very scary, triggers a very scary and damaging metabolic reaction in the body, and you don't want to go with fear. Okay, so if you're really freaked out by raw milk, then don't drink it. That's what I tell people. Just do bone broth. Do bone broth every single day. That's fine. You don't have to do raw dairy to be healthy. Okay, just do bone broth every single day, and you'll be just fine. Now, but if dairy is something that you really love, and it's a part of your life, and it's not a part of the diet that you want to have, which a lot of Northern Europeans, people of Northern European descent want. I mean, I can't imagine my life without dairy. Dairy is such a big part of my family's diet. It would really blow a big hole in our enjoyment of living if you took dairy out of our life. So if you're like me and that's, you know, dairy's big, then you need to really dig in and look at the research. And the research says that, you know what, raw milk is safe. It's actually one of the safest foods you can consume if you get it from a small farm where the cows are not treated with antibiotics and the cows are out on green pasture. And you got to go out. Sometimes you got to go look out in the pasture yourself. Make sure those cows are on some nice pasture and they're eating plenty of green food every day and they're not getting any antibiotics and that kind of thing. And that raw milk from those type of cows is very, very safe. The CDC data backs this up. If you go to my blog and type in, is raw milk safe, in the search box at the top of the header of the blog, there'll be an article there where I outline the CDC data there. And you know what else about raw milk is that it has its own inherent safety mechanism built into the raw milk. And this is the probiotics within the raw milk. And what they've done, examination of raw milk, that if they've introduced pathogens into raw milk, that the probiotics in the raw milk actually crowd out and destroy the pathogens.
Yep.
So it's inherently safe because of the high level of probiotics in good quality grass-fed raw milk. And that's the story there. So if you really kind of get beyond the standard government line on it and dig into the actual data, you'll be very surprised that raw milk is very, very safe. And that's what I found 10, 12 years ago when I first started drinking raw milk. I didn't want it. I was kind of freaked out by it at first. But once I really opened my mind and examined the data with an open mind, I was very pleasantly surprised.
Yeah. And when you had a real eggnog for the first time, your belly and your tongue said, this is right. This is good.
That's right. And I tell people, they're like, well, what does raw milk taste like? Like it's going to taste bad or something. And being from Florida where oranges and citrus is very big, I just tell people, well, you know, take the Tropicana orange juice from the store, which is arguably maybe the best brand of orange juice out there. They market it as fresh OJ, but it's pasteurized. but it doesn't come from concentrate. It's got the little bit of pulp in there. So you drink your Tropicana. Everybody thinks, oh, Tropicana orange juice, it's so good. Well, compare that to fresh squeezed.
Yeah.
Can you tell the difference? If you have a glass of fresh squeezed and a glass of Tropicana, which is the best quality pasteurized orange juice you can get from the store, taste the two. Can you tell the difference? Absolutely you can. Can't you? The fresh squeeze just tastes amazing. How do you describe that to someone? Can you describe? No, you really can't. You just say, it just tastes amazing, right?
Yeah.
Well, that's how really good quality grass-fed raw milk tastes. You just taste it and you just, it's amazing. It tastes right and your body knows it's right. And that's, you know, that's the best you can, you just have to try it to know.
It's true. You know, if we really go back to this whole kind of evidence-based, like really listening to your body, when, you know, we were all more or less raised as sugar addicts. And so our palates get conditioned to what tastes good is what is sweet. But in actuality, we both know, and many of us understand now, that a sweet craving is a protein and fat craving, really, masking itself as your body saying, I need something to eat. And you go, well, I should eat something sweet because that'll shut this up. The same thing really applies for me. When I was first introduced to quality pastured butter, I would literally just cut slabs of it off of the block and eat it. And it's like, oh, yum. My body would be like, give me another one. That's just super wonderful flavored food.
Yeah, there's an interesting story. Getting back to our caller who is a vegan. There's a vegan community here in Florida. I won't mention which one, but they were having several of their members were having some dental issues, severe dental issues. And they got a hold of my farmer, my grass-fed farmer, who does a delivery in their area, and they bought raw butter from him. And they were eating, they were so craved for, so starved for, you know, animal fats with these fat-soluble activators that they desperately needed to get the minerals back into their teeth, that they were eating the raw butter with a spoon right out of the tub.
Yeah. Okay, a couple more questions. I know we just have a few more minutes here with your gems of wisdom here, Sarah. Question here from Randa. What about the Garden of Life brand cod liver oil? The bottle says it's produced traditionally to preserve the vitamins A and D.
Well, it's my understanding that the Garden of Life cod liver oil is still heated to industrial temperatures and processed industrially. It's not raw. Now, they may put, when you heat the cod liver oil to an industrialized temperature, you destroy the vitamin A and D. So perhaps they add the A and the D back in, a natural vitamin A and D back in. So, but watch out there. The products that I've seen that add in the natural vitamin A and D, the levels of the A and D are so low. And the fact that the oils are heated, it's not something I would consider. And I don't know. I would call the company and ask, what do you mean by traditional? How do you define that? You know, what's your definition of producing cod liver oil traditionally? I mean, cod liver oil started to be industrially produced in the mid-1800s. So maybe they're saying, well, we're producing it based on how they produced it in 1850. Well, that's still not good. So, you know, you really need to maybe call them up and get some clarification on their definition of traditional.
Right. How about this one from Catherine? On the subject of phytic acid, does blanched almond flour contain phytic acid and should it be soaked? Wow, that's a detailed question. That's way out of my league.
Yeah, yes, it does still contain phytic acid. And yes, I would soak almond flour. I've never soaked almond flour. What I do is soak the almonds first, and then dehydrate them, and then grind them into flour.
Hmm.
If you're going to soak the almond flour, that would be kind of messy business, I think. I'm not sure how that would actually work. And the way the question's worded, it seems to me that maybe you're purchasing blanched almond flour from the store. I would not do that. It would be very rancid. So if you're going to use almond flour in your home, you really need to make it yourself. And you'll see the difference. If you buy almond flour from the store, it's kind of a gray color. But when you make almond flour at home, it's this beautiful golden brown color. It looks alive when you make your almond flour yourself, but the stuff at the store is kind of this dead gray color. So I would say if you're going to use almond flour, make sure you use it yourself. It's really worth it. And make big batches and freeze it. Almond flour freezes beautifully, so there's no need to have to make it all the time. Just make a big batch once a month or something and freeze it.
Perfect. I have two more questions here. We have 4 minutes. We should be just down to the wire, Sarah. What dosage are you giving your kids of the cod liver oil and the butter oil? This is from Jennifer.
Jennifer, I give my children a teaspoon of the fermented cod liver oil every day, and they get a quarter teaspoon of butter oil.
Perfect. Teaspoon of the cod liver oil and a quarter teaspoon of butter oil.
Yes, and my husband and I take a teaspoon and a half of the fermented cod liver oil and a half a teaspoon of butter oil.
Perfect. So what are your thoughts? I'm going to interject one. This question's from Will. what are your thoughts around including butter oil versus do we need to include butter oil as well as having fresh butter? Or can the fresh butter kind of, if we're having sufficient amounts, of course, could that kind of, you know, would we really need the butter oil still?
Well, I would say you need the butter oil, and here's my reasoning for that. You really need to take them together. The fermented cod liver oil and the butter oil need to be in your stomach together at the same time. That doesn't mean you need to mix them necessarily and swallow them together, although that would be ideal. And that's the way Weston Price did it, by the way. He would put drops of butter oil and cod liver oil under the tongue of people who were on their deathbed, and he frequently was able to revive them from the brink of death by doing that. That's how synergistically they work, and he noticed that using either oil separately was not as effective.
Perfect.
So you really need to take them together, but let that not be a substitute for lots of butter in your diet. So you want to take the butter oil with your cod liver oil to improve the effectiveness, make it synergistic. And also remember, this butter oil is very, very concentrated. When you spin off the solids from the butter and take it down to the oil, just the oil, you've got very, very concentrated nutrients there.
Yeah, truly. This question from Afton, the farmer I buy milk from feeds the cows grain during milking. Is that milk, should they avoid that milk? How do you handle that?
You know, I'll probably get a lot of hate email for this. I don't have any I don't have any problem with cows getting grain. Okay, I think that the argument that 100% grass feeding is best is an ideal situation. And yes, it can be achieved in certain instances when the soil is excellent, when the weather conditions are perfect, and when you have the right kind of cow, okay? But we live in an imperfect world, and you know what? Grain is a tool. And you know what I love the most about my grass-fed farmer? Let me tell you what I love about him. He doesn't get in his mind an idea about what grass feeding is or what it isn't. He does what it takes to produce awesome milk. And sometimes that involves some grain. At milking time, as long as the cow is receiving no more than, you know, 1% of its body weight per day, 1 or 2% of its body weight per day in grain, then I'm okay with it, which for a 1,000-pound Jersey, I don't know, is what, 10 or 15 pounds of grain?
Right.
If they're getting less, 10 or 15 pounds or less of grain a day, I'm okay with it. What you want to avoid are these cows that are getting the bulk of their diet of grain and they're not out on pasture. If you've got a cow out on pasture that is freely able to graze from a lush pasture at will, as much as they want,
yeah,
and they come in for milking time and they get some grain while they're being milked, that's perfectly fine.
Yeah, I think I agree with you there. You know, having a homestead farm ourselves, it really depends on the farmer and how they're approaching it. If you live in a state where you can get fresh milk or raw milk from a dairy farmer who is really pushing his cows and maximizing milk production, because obviously dairy farmers get paid on the quantity of milk that they can produce, not the quality all the time, unfortunately, but the quantity. So if you're dealing with a farmer who's really pushing his cows, realize that the more grain you feed a cow, the more milk they will produce. They'll rob their bodies. They won't, you know, that's why dairy cows are always so darn thin, because the more grain or the more feed you feed them, the more milk they'll produce. So if a farmer is really pushing his cows, then you're asking for a little bit of trouble. If on the other hand, they are getting, you know, sufficient grass, then, I don't think it's a real black and white issue for me as far as grain versus no grain. We don't use grains personally, but we also live in ideal climate where we have 12 months of rapidly growing green grass here. So we have a pretty sweet setup.
You really do. You have a great setup, and you need to make sure that you don't tell your farmer, I want 100% grass-fed milk, when maybe his farm and his cows are not ready to produce that. Because what you're going to do is you're going to start killing cows. Your cows that are not able to, cows are not able to transition overnight.
Absolutely not.
To 100% grass-fed. It's a process, and sometimes it takes the next generation of cows or subsequent generation of cows to really be able to handle that. On my farmer, my grass-fed farmer, it took him 5 years to get down to a level where the grain is absolutely minimal. It took him 5 years.
Wow.
So don't push your farmer. Don't tell your farmer how to farm. Let your farmer produce excellent milk. Find a farm that you can support, that you can champion that farm, that you can support them through thick and thin, that you are their customer and you are with them in the journey to bringing that farm back to a nutrient-dense state. And don't tell your farmer how to farm. Just, they know what you want. They want the same thing. They want nutrient-dense foods.
Yeah.
And work with them and champion them and stick with them, because that's really important. That farmer relationship is important. And don't push them to the point where the viability of the farm is threatened because of consumer demand for this or that.
Sure, sure. Really, really well put. Sarah Pope, thank you so much for just dropping so many, as our friend Sean Croxton likes to say, truth bombs here. It's been such a pleasure to have you. Everybody knows your blog, but by all means, you know, where can people read more about you?
You can find me at the healthy home economist, oneword.com. And I'll put up the video on healthy chewing gum options for tomorrow's post. I'll put that up since that was our conversation today. And you can reach me through my contact page on my blog, or you can reach me through my blog Facebook page. So I love to interact with my readers. I get tons of emails every day, but I do the best I can to help everybody as time permits.
Perfect, Sarah. Hey, thank you so much, everybody, for attending. Thank you all so much. Excellent questions here. And enjoy the summit, folks. Aloha.